It's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeBlanche. It's Justin Kaufman in with us this afternoon.
Yes,
and I'm so excited about this next interview. I'm so interested to hear what you have to say. Alex Panko is our guest. He just returned from summiting Everest. And it's remarkable what we've heard, and horrific at the same time. What we've heard just has happened there, as 11 deaths, the most, one of the records, one of the more deadly years on record. And you were there at a time when there was this line, this image, this long line of climbers. And Alex, I want you to describe to us about what it is we're seeing there. This is the final ascent to Everest, that we see this backup of all these climbers getting ready to try to summit the peak.
Yeah, right. Well, first off, you know, condolences to all the victims and their families who I can't imagine being the families of those victims. The two Americans I actually got to meet down at base camp and during the climb, so thoughts are certainly with them. You know, what you're seeing there, and I want to be careful and not completely insensitive, but we are talking about Mount Everest. First, it is a very, very dangerous mountain, and everyone who climbs needs to accept that there's a certain level of risk there. I actually summited the next day and kind of got to see some of the aftermath of this. But first off, you know, crowding isn't necessarily a surprise on Everest. The reason being is you only have 2 weeks every year where the mountain might be summitable. And of those summitable days, you might have 3 or 4 days. So last year, you had 11 straight days of good weather, and you didn't hear a thing about crowding. This year, first, we had a cyclone in the Bay of Bengal that slowed fixing of the lines to the summit. Then on top of that, the jet stream just would not leave the summit. So the winds were too high to summit. So you had this kind of condensed window. And whether you had, you know, 600 climbers this season or 400, you were going to have crowding because of the weather on these days. And this specific spot where you're looking at these pictures is the ridge between the south summit and the main summit. Best case scenario, an hour from the main summit. And the reality is you can't just pass at this point. You've seen there's tremendous exposure. It's a 6,000 foot drop, mm-hmm. and you're on about maybe a 2 foot, 3 foot wide path. So, you know, what happened isn't necessarily surprising, and it is something that you kind of need to be prepared as a possibility for going for Everest. That being said, we were kind of aware there were a lot of teams pushing that day, and we decided to sit back another day and wait for another window, and we had a very, very beautiful day. Still a decent amount of climbers, but they're spread out and moving well, which is really important. So we actually hit it the next day.
Yeah, for you, there's been much made. This story, of course, becoming an international story and people putting a lot of emphasis on the climb of Mount Everest. Where do you see this going wrong? Is it inexperienced climbers? Is it overzealous guide companies? Is it the Nepal government? Where do you see, if there's blame to be laid at anyone's feet, where do you see it?
Well, first off, you know, you don't necessarily want to blame someone for pursuing their dreams, but there do need to be standards. And what I'd say is there's two ways to do Everest. First, you can control two things: yourself, meaning being physically prepared, being having the correct experience. And the second is which sort of guide company you go with and pay for. And it's a reciprocal relationship. If you go with a good guide company that really cares about their reputation, they will not accept you if they think you are going to be a liability. I went with Adventure Consultants. I've climbed for over 3 years with them. I've done over 300 days of climbing with them. And also, if I showed up somehow unprepared, they'd turn me around. They would say, "We're not going to take you up this mountain." Also, speaking to Adventure Consultants, you pay a lot more money for a quality operator, but what does that get you?
Mm-hmm.
It gets you extra oxygen. It gets you extra flexibility, extra logistics. If I'm delayed in the death zone an hour or two during my summit bid, it doesn't become life or death for me. We have extra oxygen. If you go with one of these budget operators, they'll accept people who maybe aren't prepared. And on top of that, they're not going to have the same level of support. So you might only have 2 bottles of oxygen, and when they're done, you're done. Now, as for the people who didn't make it, I'm not going to speak to their experience,
right.
but it becomes, for them too, these people, a hazard for everyone when you have not crowds, but specific climbers and groups that are slow and not moving well. That's more of a problem than the crowds, and that becomes a hazard for everyone.
Alex, one of the things you I read an article today, I mean, you're telling your story, but just having to climb and climb over people who have died.
Yeah.
What is that like? Because that is a I can't fathom being in that position where you can't really help them. They're dead bodies at this point. You got to keep going.
Well, you know, when you go set out for Everest, one of the things that's alluring about it is its danger. And it's challenging. We all know, reading about it statistically, for every 100 climbers that make the summit, 2 will not, or invite will not, I mean, will die. And we know this going in. And my guide told me very early on in the trip, I know you know this, but seeing it is going to be something different for you. And I want to prepare you for that. And so there were several deaths before he went for the summit. An Irishman fell to his death or went missing. There were a couple others. And as we got closer to the summit, this really started to hit home for me. And I said, I don't have to do this. You can go back home, Alex. You can go back to your family. I was stubborn and pushed through. And we went the day after that line. And because people had been up in the death zone for so long without oxygen, we saw rescues. And these rescues were dire. We saw Sherpas trying to take people down who were basically comatose. Mm-hmm. And as I walked up higher, this was in the first 10 minutes of leaving Camp 4. It was one after another after another. And then there were two bodies on the way up that were still attached to the lines. So they weren't from previous seasons. And you step over them, and there's a little... First off, you're very hypoxic. So you're not really thinking the same. You're really just trying to put one foot in front of the other. But even so, I still felt a little bit of, you know, this is... You're stepping over bodies. There's a bit of humanity in that for me. You know, you're just chasing your objective and stepping over them. But we also know when you sign up for a mountain like Everest, that's a possibility. And if you can't stomach that, you're not ever going to get to the top, because every year there's going to be those.
It's unbelievable. You spent a month, though, at base camp, I read. And that's not typical for someone to do that. Does that speak also to your guide group?
Well, we spent a month acclimating. So it was between base camp and then two rotations on the mountain. You go through the icefall, which is the most dangerous part, actually. It's at the beginning. To camp 1 and 2 on your first rotation, come mm-hmm. back to base camp, then camp 1, camp 2, camp 3, all without oxygen to acclimate. So it's really a process, and the patience there and waiting for weather. And it's really, really, really hard. And as a client, you really want to respect your guides, because you've invested all this time and money, and you see the first window and you want to go jump on it. And thank God for me, I have a company that says, hey, Alex, you know, we don't like the look of some of the groups that are going up there. It's going to be crowded and the weather's okay. Tomorrow, there's still going to be crowds, but we know the groups that are going up. We know the quality of their clients, and we know the weather is going to be good. We didn't have an empty summit day. I'd guess probably around 150 people, but if you look at my photos, you don't see lines. You don't see mass groups of climbers, because the groups that went, they know each other. They move well. Mm-hmm. If there's a slower group, they'll let a faster group pass as a group. Mm-hmm. It's very well controlled the day I went.
So you likely that was, it was just a safer day to go, you would say.
It was a safer day to go, and one of the groups, you know, just to be blunt, one of the groups that was going on the 22nd, we saw them descending our first rotation as they were coming up, mm-hmm. and you had people being short roped by guides. That means basically hauled up the mountain the first stage, meaning through the icefall, because they were physically shot already. And if you're physically shot at the very bottom of the mountain, you're not going to get stronger. You have no business being there. And then, like I said, you know, the two Americans who passed away, you know, good climbers, and I'm not sure the exact details, but sounds like they were up there for too long with their maybe some health ailments popped up. When you have slow climbers like that slowing everyone, it jeopardizes everyone. But it's not a quantity, it's a quality game again, because if you have good climbers moving well, it doesn't seem to show up.
You mentioned we're talking with Alex Panko. He just got back from Mount Everest, a Chicagoan who climbs, and we want to talk about all of the climbing you've done, and talk about Peaks of Mind, which is peaksofmind.org, and raising money for charity. You talked about the physical. And you right at the beginning, you talked about, you know, if you don't have it at the bottom, you're not going to have it at the top. But it sounds like this is a mental game, because as you mentioned earlier, you wanted to turn. Your brain is telling you, turn back, turn back, turn back. How do you mentally prepare for climbing Mount Everest?
I mean, you certainly have to be stubborn. There is a little bit of an ego involved. It's also type 2 fun. You know, you're not having fun doing it, but it is fun after the fact to say you did it. First off, yeah, mentally the whole time, all you're thinking about is Chicago food, Portillo's, stuff like that, every single meal. The worst thing is reading about the Cubs and seeing photos of your friends at Cubs games. You say, why am I doing this again? You don't shower much. You have a bucket that the chefs have to heat and boil, and you have a little spout then, and you're sleeping a lot of the time when you're on the mountain on rough ground. You don't sleep much. There are days where I'd go 2-3 days with a combined 4 hours sleep. And yeah, you just have to want it. You really have to want it. And it really helps to have a strong team and guide members then with a little bit of friendly competition, because anytime you're not feeling it, you talk to someone on your team and they say, oh, I can't wait to summit, and it gets your mojo and swag back. Mm-hmm. But the mental part, 2 months from home, is hard.
I bet. Alex, can you have a minute to stick around here? Because you have an amazing backstory as well that we want to let people in on. Talk about why you're doing it, other than just for the thrill and the sheer achievement of it. That you have a story we want to hear more about. Our guest is Alex Panko. He just returned from Everest, and we're going to hear more from him in just a minute. But let's check in with Kim Gordon now, see what's coming up top of the hour in the news.
As the spring session winds down in Springfield, lawmakers are busy pushing their key agenda items.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Kim Gordon from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio. It's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeBlantis. Justin Kaufman and I are here this afternoon, and our guest is Alex Panko, an incredible story. He summited Everest over the past week. It was last Thursday, was it, when you summited? Thursday morning?
23rd, whichever day that is.
Whichever day. You probably do lose track of time, right? And just everything.
Oh, it's really crazy. Sometimes you come back from a rotation, you haven't even read the news in 10 days, and sometimes the headlines can be pretty shocking when you're gone for 10 days.
What are some of the physical ailments that you come down the mountain with?
Well, so on this climb, on the way down, because I was spent on energy, literally became hypoxic, out-of-body experience, hallucinations, wasn't exactly sure where I was, which is really dangerous because you can't mess up on the way down. No. I had a little voice in the back of my head saying, plant the foot, pay attention, and it was just enough to get me down. But then it got worse as I went down, which shouldn't be happening, and I learned I actually have an pneumonia from my summit push. So made it down, though. Other than that, you have no appetite up there. It's really hard to eat. Your body is burning, 10 to 15,000 calories some days, and you're not eating, and it consumes muscle, not fat. So you become actually really progressively weaker during these climbs while you're acclimating.
We have a listener is asking, and you don't have to tell how much you paid, but what is the range that people have to pay for this type of, to be able to scale Everest?
You know, it's 30 to 100,000, and I would say the sweet spot for safety is at 60. At that point, you start to add on more for luxury items such as a stand-up tent at base camp.
I see. And you're raising money for a cause. We should mention that. You were diagnosed with a brain tumor at 18, and Lurie Children's Hospital was where you went for treatment. And since then, your climbing is benefiting that hospital.
Yeah, just first off, for all the listeners, I pay for all the climbs out of pocket. This was a project I started just on my own to go climb. And then it started to get a little attention, and I'm very involved with Lurie Children's, so I got the idea to bring the Lurie banner to the top of each mountain, dedicate the climbs to kids, both former and current patients who are battling brain tumors, since I had one as a kid. Did I even get to that part? I did as a kid, and it was benign, so everything was a positive outcome, but I became very involved with them. Yeah, it's a very, very dear organization to me, and to bring attention and raise funds for a hospital like Lurie's in the Chicago community has been a huge privilege, and it keeps me going. The signed flag from all these patients I brought up Everest. Sometimes when I thought about quitting, I said, I'd promised these kids I was going to fly the banner from Lurie's, and they're battling physical, mental, way more than me without a choice. So I definitely use that as motivation. So in that way, it's a nice reciprocal relationship.
You made it to the top of 6 of the 7 summits, the highest on each continent, also the North and South Pole. I mean, you have done just amazing things, Alex, and you're raising money. You're about to do Denali.
Yes. So first off, we're at 450,000 plus now. It's actually gained a lot of momentum with Everest, and I kind of have to recalibrate and add that all up. But You know, Lurie's, it's not only a great hospital for kids. We talk about the holistic level with Anthony Rizzo, and they kind of, I like to tell people, are a Make-A-Wish Foundation every day for these kids.
Sure.
But they're also getting results. Several of these kids who I've brought attention to have a tumor called an ATRT that 10, 15 years ago would have been, you know, they wouldn't have stood a chance, and they're doing well now because of institutions like Lurie's. So we've raised over $450,000. Mm-hmm. I really want to hit that $500,000 mark, and it has come from small donations from Chicago, and so it's been
thank you
awesome.
To everyone who's contributed. Peaksofmind.org. Our news person, Kim Gordon, has a question for you as well, Alex.
Alex, okay. I just want to know, how long is the recovery process once you're back down on the, you know, on the ground out of that high altitude, and how much time do you give yourself in between these climbs?
Normally a lot of time, at least a couple of months. I have 2 weeks before Denali, which is...
oh, my goodness.
Well, you know what? I'll be honest. It's been 3 years, and as I was joking about, but serious about, I'm ready to just enjoy some Cubs games in Wrigley Field in summertime Chicago, finally, and not think about climbing. It's been the most gratifying thing in the world. It's also been very, very, very difficult.
Sure.
So I'm really excited for Denali, but I'm definitely going to be a bit weaker from Everest. However, I will also be acclimated to the altitude.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a draw is what I like to think of.
What was the toughest? When you, I mean, I don't know if anybody you've ever had in studio who has climbed and summited six peaks. Like, what is the toughest in this globe that we live in that you experienced?
You know, it's really funny. That answer depends so much for different people based on how they feel that day. Some people will say Kilimanjaro is the hardest summit day because they're not feeling well. For me, from a mental standpoint, by far Everest, simply because I did Cho'oyu to train. It's an 8,000-meter peak. It was a four-week trip, and I was fine with that. Above 4 weeks, it really just starts to drag on you and really mentally starts to wear on you. So from a mental standpoint, definitely Everest. Physically, you know, this is my second return trip to Denali. The difference is we don't have the amazing Sherpas we have on Everest. So we're carrying 120 pounds up that mountain. Mm. So even though it's not as high, it's a very, very physical mountain. Although, to be fair, a lot of these mountains, you'd be surprised. It's patience waiting around in terrible conditions in a tent and waiting for your window.
Yeah.
How tall is, how high is Denali?
It's 20,000 feet.
That's nothing. That's
I know. Almost. I could do that. Almost. Maybe not. The other thing I want to clear up, too, I kept hearing that because people were taking so long in this selfie-taking world that we live in, that the actual summit, when people summited, they took longer up there, and that is a lot smaller than you might think. In the Tribune story, they called it like the size of two dining tables. So really, you can't fit that many people up there. And were they taking more time than you would have thought?
So when you're up there, it's not just people. People leave flags and time to the prayer flags up there, and there's no fixed lines at the summit. So it's basically a giant tripping hazard. That being said, you know, honestly, when you're up there, you're so elated to be up there. You're not even, you have to be careful watching your steps, but we had people come and go. We had some decent moments on the summit with just a few people. Then the next group would get there. But it was just, you know, when you're up there, you're not even thinking about that. You're just so happy to be up there.
Alex, we could talk to you for hours. We so appreciate you coming in. We want to mention it's peaksofmind.org where you can go to contribute as you are 2 weeks away from your Denali climb and collecting donations for Lurie Children's Hospital, something very close to your heart. So thank you for talking with us, and please come back after Denali and talk to us again.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. We've got, it's time for the news. WGN Radio wants to send you on a Blackhawks getaway for two in Europe. Listen to Win Your Way to Pucks in Prague weekday mornings at 7:40 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. The news, it's time for that. Here's Kim Gordon.